Testing, testing. This is tape number 12 of Goblinhood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblinhood. This tape commences shortly after the solution of the impalement murder case. As for the other widows, she'd seen some of them at the big fracas centering around the impaler, but in the excitement they'd forgotten to remind her of the Star Trek festival, which they'd all been planning for weeks. Or maybe they'd let her forget it deliberately so that she'd remain with her charge even if the gob was in one of his less social moods. As it was, she and Goblinhood had come back to the palace and collapsed into bed immediately after wrapping up the Vlad Sepish affair. After a long snooze, they'd gotten up, gotten loaded, gotten horny, and were just starting to get their rocks off when the best detective in town had showed up with a bottle of bubbly, wanting to celebrate about cracking the big case. And the Star Trek festival? Originally, the Black Widows had conceived it as a lark, as one more time-wasting frolic. But now they'd started it a little prematurely, on the spur of the moment, following Vlad's demise. Goblinhood's pronouncement about the fate of Vlad, or rather, about its implications, had set everybody's nerves on edge. Now the widows were using the sheer monotony of the Star Trek extravaganza as a kind of drug, on top of all their other drugs, to keep from having to think about anything. Meanwhile, the most interesting thing about Gene Roddenberry's brainchild and its heirs was the weird light that Star Trek shed upon the whole concept of adventure fiction. If one watched the show long enough, it became evident what a big pain in the ass adventures are for the characters who have to endure them. In the original series from the 60s, this was best exemplified in a segment written by science fiction master Theodore Sturgeon, in which everybody beamed down to some idyllic planet where alien pods affected their senses, infecting them with a sense of utopia. Nobody but Captain Kirk wanted to go back on the spaceship anymore. Nobody wanted to go flying around the galaxy looking for trouble anymore. Not even the unemotional Spock, who was now in love. And that was basically their secret attitude throughout the series, with Scotty loudly bellyaching every time anything went wrong with the ship, Bones grouching about all the medical problems they kept encountering, Kirk acting like making love to a new woman and beating up a new villain every week was this big aching chore. Years later, in Star Trek The Next Generation, this state of affairs still obtained, except that now the crew had the sardonic and wildly psionic alien Q hanging around half the time, taunting them about the essential futility of their pointless activities and escapades. It was as if all the characters wanted was to simply sit there on the bridge of the Enterprise for an hour every week, chatting and looking at the stars. everything that happened on the space station Deep Space Nine in the spin-off of the same name was a disaster, virtually driving the station personnel to distraction. One almost wondered why they didn't all just pack up and go home. By the time Star Trek Voyager hit the screen, the characters were actually complaining about this outright, wondering why they couldn't just get the hell home with the utmost dispatch instead of sticking their noses into virtually every potentially disastrous space anomaly they came across. Enough Black Widows, all adorned with Vulcan ears and the like, were simply wallowing in this, immersing themselves in the endless, mind-numbing banality of somebody else's nerve-wracking adventures, so that they wouldn't have to face the rigors of the immense adventure that they themselves were stuck in the middle of, brought home to them by a fly in the ointment named Vlad Sepes. It was what escapism was all about. Goblinhood, meanwhile, had magicked up some champagne glasses, and now he and his two comrades drank a kind of toast.
"To the three musketeers of Vlad the Impaler," chirped the Shogun Squirrel expansively, clicking his glass to theirs.
G.H. and his paramour exchanged amused glances, both wondering how long the best detective in town was planning to behave itself in a quasi-civilized manner, how long it would be before the restless squirrel started insulting them or trying to get under their skin about one thing or another. Not very long. The Shogun squirrel sniffed frustrated sex in the air, realized what it had interrupted, and wanted to slyly rub it in.
"Do you think the elephant people are sleeping with each other?"
the little asshole gossiped in a would-be innocent manner. "Come to think of it," remembered Mandragora, reading the squirrel's dirty little mind, "there should be several weeks worth of Star Trek stuff to look at, including all the alternate versions. Maybe we should go after all."
"No, wait,"
bleated the rodent, breaking out its social ace in the hole.
"I thought we could get stoned."
It dragged forth a large joint and struck a match. It was back to being the warm and furry, kinder and gentler, and damned near cute and cuddly Shogun squirrel that they so loved to tolerate. The others were already higher than kites, but they partook of the squirrel's offering out of politesse. It turned out to be really crappy, homegrown garbage weed, but the squirrel, who seldom turned on and probably didn't know the difference, got ripped to the tits on it. Mandragora went to put a tape on the gob's stereo. By chance, she selected 200 motels.
"You know, in St. Cloud's book," she asked G.H., "where he wonders how the orchestra felt about being in the film? Well, I saw another tape about the making of 200 Motels, and in that flick, Zappa accused the orchestra of trying to sabotage the show and of vandalizing their rented tuxedos."
"How depressing," moped the gob, oddly disappointed and thinking that the more one knows about what's going on, the less one wants to know. The Shogun squirrel didn't know what they were talking about because it had only read the pornographic parts of St. Cloud's book. Besides, it wanted to talk about Vlad the Impaler as a pretext for rehashing the whole glorious adventure once again. But as soon as the topic came up, owing to a clumsy segue with which the Shogun Squirrel tried to equate tuxedo vandalism with impaling people, Goblinhood pedantically started telling what he called funny stories about the historical Vlad, who had had a vicious sense of humor. One time, chuckled the gob, Vlad received some Turkish ambassadors who wouldn't remove their hats in his presence. They claimed that it wasn't the custom in their land to remove one's hat for the monarch. So Vlad had their hats nailed to their heads. He almost collapsed, cackling with sick mirth as the squirrel gaped stupidly and Mandragora looked on pityingly. And another time, he continued hilariously, some visiting nobleman complained about the stench from the forest of impaled corpses around, so Vlad had this guy impaled high above the others where he wouldn't have to smell them.
Yes, commented the squirrel snidely, impalement aside, all those gaping human asses must have stunk pretty bad.
It sniffed the air and glanced significantly at Mandragora's naked butt. Yes, well, the funniest story about Vlad the Impaler, growled Goblinhood, glaring at the squirrel significantly, is the one about the time he was imprisoned for years. He made friends with his jailers and got them to bring in small animals, dogs, cats, rodents, that sort of thing. These he tortured and mutilated, and then he impaled them on little stakes in little rows there around his cell.
Good Lord, choke, barfed the squirrel,
failing to see the humor and losing its champagne at the same time. It's possible that the madhouse scenes involving Stoker's character Renfield were based on this story, G.H. blandly mentioned to Mandragora, who was glowering at the fresh squirrel puke on the floor. She made Goblinhood clean it up, too. In all fairness, it wasn't that the gob really thought Vlad's antics were funny, though the gob could see a kind of sardonic humor about almost anywhere. Particularly when he was this stoned. But what amused him so much about these tales was how childish and berserk Vlad appeared to be acting in them. The last story especially, if true, shed some real light on Vlad's character, suggesting as it did that the deranged despot had had some deep inner need to commit impalement, or that he had somehow defined himself that way and would even settle for impaling harmless little animals just to keep his hand in. Perhaps the funniest part was that his captors didn't seem to care about such quirks. All they cared about was that he became Catholic and married the head honcho's daughter. Then they let him go. The Shogun Squirrel, meanwhile, had passed out from shock and abhorrence at the dismal fate of its hapless little peers so long ago. Goblinhood and Mandragora chatted now over its prostrate form and over fresh cups of ichor that they brewed up. During the conversation which ensued, Mandragora found herself in a strange position vis-a-vis goblinhood. For once, she not only didn't know what he was going to say next, but she wasn't able to read his thoughts very well either. She'd had little enough trouble reading the squirrel's mind earlier, but then the squirrel's simplistic thoughts had seldom been hard to read. They were about as subtle as the braying of a jackass. Even now, in its semi-comatose state, the traumatized little rascal was dimly projecting exclamations such as,
"The horror! The horror!"
But goblinhood was another matter. In his mind, had been growing progressively opaque to her all evening, for reasons which remained mysterious. Whatever was going wrong with the regularly scheduled natural laws of Sodom seemed to be intensifying steadily since the death of Vlad, and in unpredictable ways. It was as if goblinhood was right in thinking that something analogous to an ozone layer was suddenly and rapidly undergoing a final collapse. It was odd, to her mind, that this telepathic faculty would be compromised while normal psionic telekinetic ability remained unaffected, as witnessed the champagne glasses produced out of nowhere by the gob. For the first time, she wondered, a little guiltily, whether the telepathic abilities of the Black Widows had somehow been connected to the overall harmlessness gaze. The Widows had, after all, basically embodied what law and order there was in Sodom, both through their single-minded numbers and through monitoring other people's thoughts, and, as had sort of been the case with Pinkovsky, preventing trouble, maybe in permitting the lynching of Vlad, they had corrupted their powers by abdicating their responsibilities, or maybe close proximity to Vlad's Christian magic field had somehow poisoned their abilities, or maybe something else was going on. The psychic deafness scared her a little, especially since she was also having trouble contacting the other widows. Her telepathic communications with them had always been just a bit strained due to precognitive static. The other Black Widows had always found her convoluted previsions to be extremely disorienting. But now she kept getting the equivalent of a telepathic busy signal from that quarter, as if the Trekkie Fest was taking up every iota of their full attention. Consequently, as her psychic discomfort was intensified by the ichor's bizarre effects, she found herself clinging desperately to the conversation like a drowning swimmer clinging to a buoyant chunk of wood. Any communication at all was better than feeling her mind close up completely, and her questions, for a change, were prompted by real curiosity. Frantic curiosity, in fact. As a precognitive telepath, she'd often felt as if she knew everything, and now her storehouse of knowledge seemed empty and desolate. That she could expect goblinhood to fill it back up is an indication of how little accurate knowledge she retained.
Still, she was comforted to have someone to talk to during a time of such stress, even if it was only someone like the god. And oddly, for all their previous psychic intimacy, this was actually the closest she'd ever gotten emotionally to her strange lover, in the sense, perhaps, of what would ordinarily constitute a normal relationship between average people. Or maybe it was just that she'd always pretty much known what he was thinking, but without truly knowing how it felt for him to be isolated, cut off from direct knowledge, forced to guess what might be going on in someone else's mind. Now she knew, and it forced her to identify with his viewpoint and to see him in a new light. She found the experience to be both disturbing and strangely exhilarating. Never before had life seemed so full of surprises. One bee she still had in her bonnet concerned Goblinhood's obscure Martian and Lovecraftian affiliations. She'd never quite been able to wholly abandon what she thought of as her Nurgle theory, not even after Vlad Tsepish had bitten the bag in regards to the impalement murders. One problem she'd come up against here, as had all of her sisters at one time or another, was that not even telepathy could sort out the gob's thoughts on this subject. Mandragora knew what the Martian was supposed to look like, but knew too that this was just an image Goblinhood had assigned to Nurgle, whom Goblinhood had never actually seen, nor apparently had the entity's presence ever been registered in any tangible way. Instead, the gob simply remembered a time lasting from about August of 1986 to sometime early in 1988, when things in his life had been even more fucked up than usual, and in what he considered unusual ways. None of the widows, in sifting through these confused memories, had ever been able to detect the subtle nuances that Goblinhood seemed to set such store by. Worse yet, his belief in the Martian Zoni was countered, as were a lot of his beliefs, by an almost equal disbelief in even the possibility of any such phenomenon. But however it muddied the waters of his thoughts, this skeptical streak of his struck the telepathic sisterhood as merely a defense mechanism, a self-taught exercise in denial, which allowed the gob to blunder through one psionic or occult situation after another without ever fully absorbing any of it. What the Black Widows did know for certain was this, that Goblinhood's prolonged and presumptive encounter with Nurgle had definitely provoked the gob into dealing with his own paranormal abilities by creating the Martian harmlessness sigil, and that his belief in the importance of the sigil was among the strongest of his convictions. Nor could he afford even the slightest hint of skepticism regarding this, for fear that the magic sigil might stop working if he stopped believing in it, even momentarily. Mandragora not only believed in Nurgle's existence, but was still half convinced that Nurgle somehow lay at the bottom of any difficulties plaguing Goblinhood.
Even now, she still considered it possible, or even probable, that the whole psionic breakdown problem going on in Sodom at this time was just a clever gambit on the invisible Marson's part. And she didn't hesitate to express this idea to the gob. Maybe Vlad only thought he was working for the Christian God, but it was actually Nurgle in disguise, she argued. After all, those quasi-Martian clues at the first crime scene never did get fully explained. That had occurred to Goblinhood as well, but thinking about it made him quite uneasy. It bothered him to imagine the capricious Marson attacking him this way. For one thing, it implied a persistent and long-festering grudge on the part of Nurgle, who probably just couldn't fucking wait for the harmlessness barrier to finally finish breaking down. And what would happen then? Was Nurgle connected to the Martian Provisional Government? Asked Mandragora, who had never been very clear in her mind on matters regarding the MPG. This was probably because G.H. had never been very organized in his thoughts on the subject, any more than he had in his thoughts regarding the Martian Zoni affair itself. A very frustrating state of affairs, telepathically speaking. What good is knowing something if the something turns out to be gibberish? The difference, though, seemed to be that Goblinhood worried about Nurgle, as with something beyond his control, but only regarded the Martian Provisional Government as some sort of joke or something. It was as if the concept of the MPG was just a background prop, always there but never fully explained. Mandragora knew that Goblinhood equated it with the Renegade Club, but she'd sensed at times that it meant more than that, too. Now it was up to Goblinhood to explain it to her as best he could. The Martian Provisional Government had actually evolved from events which occurred during Goblinhood's first major performance, in any formal sense, which took place in his original universe in 1991. Prior to this, the MPG had just been a relatively meaningless name that he'd made up and associated with Goblinhood to give the character more clout, or, on the other hand, to give Goblinhood someone to blame everything on whenever it was time for him to say things like, "I'm only the postman." By the time of that first performance, Goblinhood had been around as a character for about 9 years, ever since his creation as a life-size painting in a public mural entitled Synchronauts. This mural had been created with a grant from the Ohio Arts Council, which may have influenced G.H. in his strong advocacy of freedom of expression in the arts and of public support for the arts. The mural itself had had an interesting history. Painted in 1982, the building it was in had burned down later that same year, but the Goblinhood mural and another mural by the same artist had been unharmed in the fire. After being disassembled by volunteers, the murals had been framed, removed, and shuttled from one temporary refuge to another for years. In fact, as far as Goblinhood knew, these huge framed panels were still languishing around in storage somewhere, in another universe far away. In passing, it could be mentioned that goblinhood had had a different look back then, mostly in terms of his mask. The original mask had been modeled, ironically, after a mask worn by the Elephant Man in the David Lynch film of the same name. Certainly John, Joan, and Jack would have found this ironic. At the time, G.H. had even nicknamed himself the Elevator Man, for reasons never fully explained, though it probably had something to do with elevators. The first mask, made from canvas, painted abstractly with acrylics, had been heavy, bulky, and uncomfortable. Eventually, goblinhood had abandoned it in favor of no mask at all. This finally gave way to the current mask, which wasn't created until 1990, well after the Martian harmlessness sigil had been pioneered. Back in those early days, goblinhood hadn't been around much in public, though his creator had been quite active during the prolonged rescue of the murals, even appearing a couple of times on the regular television news. But one of the strongest images from that strange era was private, not public, and was also Lovecraftian in the extreme. In his brilliant novel, At the Mountains of Madness, H.P.L. had described the entire history of an alien race through mural sculptures found in Antarctic ruins, traces of a vanished civilization, a lost world. The narrator had even mentioned that the best of the murals seemed to have been removed when the ancient city was abandoned. Now here was the gob's creator, haunting the frigid, burned-out ruins of a defunct community center, keeping a wary eye out for Lovecraftian monsters and helping to frame the relics of a lost counterculture civilization within the doomed building's unheated shell throughout the bitter winter of 1983. And why wasn't goblinhood on hand for all these festivities? Well, back in those carefree, halcyon, bygone days of yesteryear and yore, the world just wasn't quite ready for the old gobster in the flesh, having only recently banished his painted image to a kind of lost world limbo. But this fact wasn't entirely responsible for goblinhood's absence from public view during the epoch in question. Even during the heyday of the mural, goblinhood had existed very much in the shadow of a much better established character called Buckethead, who was their creator's first formal and fairly successful performance character, or example of what he called intermedia, a merging of comics, paintings, film or video, and real life. Somewhere in through there, goblinhood got mixed up with St. Cloud in an alternate future in another dimension. The story about working for a gallery with a computer was completely bogus, by the way. Actually, the gob's creator, pretty much of a lone wolf at the time, just typed St. Cloud's junk on a typewriter, and St. Cloud never knew the difference. It remains unclear, however, what the typist's motive was for fostering the illusion of his gallery affiliations, even apparently in his own mind, according to his writings. But perhaps he thought telling that story would lend him some kind of prestige with St. Cloud and, who knows, even with his own readers later on. Or maybe the artist, typist, had ambitions toward working with the gallery someday, as later events show that he actually did wind up doing. As for why he wanted to read St. Cloud's book badly enough to type it, that must remain a matter for speculation, unless one wants to count the theory suggested by the typist himself that St. Cloud was an alternate version of himself, in which case the information contained in the book might indeed have seemed interesting or important to him. But then, who knows why artists do anything? The St. Cloud factor, incidentally, illustrates the biggest difference between Buckethead and the Gob. Buckethead was a lot closer to their creator, in that his only headgear was a hand-painted helmet made from a plastic bucket that he'd once used for holding paint water or glaze. Bucky could never have dreamed of doing the kinds of performance activities that G.H. wound up so steeped in, nor, for that matter, could Goblin Hood himself have gotten away with running around bare-assed in public and on public television if he'd been using their creator's precious and not to be besmirched human face. Both St. Cloud's influence then and the influence of the Goblins himself can be regarded as disinhibiting agents. Meanwhile, Buckethead's own relatively inhibited career lasted about 7 years, and mostly just consisted of running around in public wearing a hand-painted costume with a bucket on his head, carrying his trusty sidekick, the Amazing Suitcase Doll. And what was so amazing about the Suitcase Doll? Here's one good example. Several versions of the doll were on display, along with most of his creator's most important paintings, let alone the murals in that community center on the night it burned down. Oddly, though, none of the artist's work was seriously damaged in a fire so destructive that the building itself wound up having to be razed to the ground. Coincidence or what? Buckethead's most formal activities centered around a local high school where he and Suitcase were frequent and popular participants in a speaker series involving alternative political thought. Buckethead often recited a poem, actually a little song, called Citizen Pain, during these presentations. Otherwise, to the extent that he was talking about anything, Buckethead talked about art as a kind of political force. It was left for Goblin Hood to narrow the topic down to freedom of expression. Late in 1986, Goblin Hood first began to assume these chores for Buckethead, who had failed as a character to weather the psychic Martian onslaught of Nurgle. His costume had sort of failed to survive as well. The helmet, in particular, was crumbling to junk. Goblin Hood himself was between masks at the time, letting his creator's bare face hang out, covered only by a monkish cowl. Yet he still had the brass to claim credit for Buckethead's death, like some sort of art terrorist or something. Later, though, the newly spider-masked Gobster withdrew this claim, instead characterizing his predecessor's untimely demise as an accident. By this time, he and his creator really were affiliated with a public gallery where their first real performance, a science fiction poetry opera called Citizen Pain, took place in 1991. In Citizen Pain, the Gob presided over Buckethead's funeral, as a kind of prologue, and also portrayed all of the story's characters, except for one called the Ghost of Buckethead. Citizen Payne actually had a storyline, albeit an absurd one. As space opera, however, it probably wasn't too much more ridiculous than Edison's Conquest of Mars, the unofficial sequel to Wells's War of the Worlds, published in 1898 by journalist astronomer Garrett P. Serviss. The Citizen Payne story began with Goblin Hood portraying a character named Private Hell, a controversial artist who was engaged in an art war over freedom of expression. By the time this somehow escalated into a full-scale nuclear war, Private Hell had been promoted in the field and was now calling himself General Idea, the only survivor of the global conflagration, a genetic mutant with psionic powers, such as the ability to survive a nuclear war. The plot thickened. Alone amid the rubble, General Idea was faced with the Herculean task of body disposal, if only for public health reasons. Though his own psionic talents weren't up to the job, he knew of someone who might be able to accomplish it, a vastly powerful, time-traveling, interplanetary wizard called the Warlock of Mars, who supposedly resided on Mars. But how to get to Mars and alert the fabled warlock to the mortuary problems on Earth? A good question. Eventually, General Idea wound up walking, since he couldn't drive a car, from the ruins of Columbus, Ohio, his hometown, to the ruins of a secret underground space installation somewhere in what was left of Siberia, rumored to house an operational Mars lander vehicle built during Palmyra days by the former Soviets, whose empire had, of course, crumbled even before the fatal war. Eventually, finding this and educating himself enough to be able to jury-rig a way to make it run single-handed took the determined general several years. By the time he got to Mars, he was an old man, and the bodies had mostly all long since decomposed. But he still thought that the collective corpse of humanity deserved a decent burial, so he spent his last energy tracking down the near-legendary Warlock of Mars. Apprised of the situation, the Warlock used his magic powers to travel back in time and space to Earth at a moment shortly after General Idea had left for Siberia. The Warlock surveyed the ruins of Columbus, Ohio, with sorrow, and decided that humanity, though foolishly self-destructive, deserved a fitting eulogy before it was consigned to the ground, and that only the Ghost of Buckethead could do the eulogy justice with a poem that poor Buckethead had never gotten to perform in life. So the Warlock went back to Mars, his place of greatest power, to conjure Buckethead's shade up to recite a semi-elegiac poem entitled Glass Organs. But amazingly, the Warlock's spell was so strong that it inadvertently wound up bringing back to life everyone who had been killed in the war, including the Gob's audience there in Columbus. And thus was the Martian Provisional Government born. Among other things, the Warlock's job had been to prevent nuclear war, which he'd done quite satisfactorily on Mars. At this point, however, after the warlock had wasted most of his power briefly reanimating part of Buckethead and resurrecting everyone else too as an unforeseen side effect, it was now up to everyone else to prevent nuclear war by order of the Martian Provisional Government. This way, if nuclear war ever did break out again, the warlock, alias Goblin Hood, as de facto head of the MPG, could blame it on the rest of the MPG, i.e., everybody, to whom he delegated all the authority regarding that matter. Buckethead's ghost aside, by the time of the Citizen Payne show, Buckethead mostly only consisted of a grisly relic called the Head of Buckethead, which Goblin Hood treated as a kind of John the Baptist figure. This was particularly true in a performance called The Crucifixion of Goblin Hood in spring of 1993, when a bunch of the Gob's fellow gallery affiliates took the trouble on Good Friday to crucify him, one of his last major performances before mysteriously disappearing from that universe. The Head of Buckethead had disappeared with him, but had played no great part in the other dimensional history of Sodom. Yet the Head of Buckethead was also part of the Martian Provisional Government, since even the warlock's inanimate sidekicks, the suitcase and cosmic weevil dolls, were card-carrying charter members. Even Maya, assuming she'd even been manufactured at that time, was part of the warlock's big bad Martian Provisional Government. And so, yes, in that sense, Nurgle was part of the Martian Provisional Government, like everybody and everything else. It could even be said that Nurgle was an extremely active MPG functionary, since Goblin Hood, alias the Warlock of Mars, had a tendency to blame all kinds of things on Nurgle, not just any nuclear wars that might chance to happen. And now, for that matter, here was Mandragora trying to do that too. By this point, in Goblin Hood's convoluted and nigh endless answer to her simple question, Mandragora had achieved a state of mind bordering on stunned apathy, which was, in a way, exactly what she wanted, to be bored or otherwise lulled into forgetting about her own problems for a while. But some of this stuff interested her. She'd never, for instance, heard of Goblin Hood's secret origin before, as if, even in his supposedly private thoughts, the improbable mural epic was too complicated to think about, much less to use as an accessible explanation for his existence. Mandra was also intrigued by Private Hell. Did that character's presence in the play signify that you were still mixed up with Christianity? She wanted to know. Not exactly, replied G.H. In fact, he was actually left over from the 1976 painting in which my creator had started deliberately abandoning Christianity for good. So, Private Hell even predated Buckethead. This was another long story, but here's the gist of it. In 1976, while the Martian Sphinx was first coming out of the closet out yonder, Goblin Hood's creator was working on a painting called Arenas. essentially a lavish portrait of the artist's mother, steeped in quasi-Christian symbolism. This eventually became one of his two most popular and respected paintings. The other was Millennium, which during a national symposium on freedom of expression at Anchorage, Alaska in 1992 had been rated, according to questionnaires, about fourth in audience popularity out of the work of some 40 artists from around the country, which simply meant, in this context, that his was among the censored artwork that audience happened to dislike the least. But the creator of Arenas, who was used to portraying the ugly side of things in his work, who indeed had to virtually transcend himself to see any other side, much less portray it, that pessimistic painter had to work damned hard to keep Arenas from becoming as ugly as most of his other work had always been. He accomplished this by putting all the really ugly stuff that he felt at the time into a separate painting of hell, which he usually referred to as the Inferno painting. The Inferno painting, in passing, included a couple of prominent characters called Private Hell and General Idea, self-portraits distinguishable by the quasi-military hand-painted jackets which they wore, jackets which actually existed and which the painter, also a fledgling performance artist, sometimes wore around on the street when certain moods hit him. As it later turned out, the Inferno painting eventually wound up being among his most notorious and troublesome creations. Rumor had it, for instance, that one small university gallery had to close down for a year after showing this and other paintings by the artist, which was why he'd been involved in that Alaskan symposium and exhibit to begin with. But oddly, for all its sadomasochistic and sardonic belligerence, this painting also led him away from the concept of hell by forcing him to think logically about the concept and to try reconciling it with the idea of a just and loving God. One thing that occurred forcefully to him was that hell would have to be the most crowded place in the universe, and that large amounts of its occupants would wind up there merely for not believing in that particular just and loving God, which, in the context of eternity, smacked just a little of overkill. In the end, he composed his painting around the central image of a mystical stairway out of the place, not to heaven, but simply to cold, clean oblivion. The artist just couldn't bring himself to be as vicious as the Christian God was supposed to be. And though based on an actual scriptural or apocryphal reference to Christ's so-called harrowing of hell, the artist's merciful version of the place amounted to a pretty serious Christian heresy, especially where eternal hellfire and damnation oriented Southern Baptists like those in his own sect were concerned. Though it was probably the painting's violence, explicit sexual content, and political sarcasm that actually pissed people off so much. For the artist, though, the spiritual dichotomy between what he'd been taught and what he actually believed, as illustrated by this painting, eventually led to his apostasy from any form of Christianity, and thence to his search for a new faith. Nowadays, goblinhood seldom entertained the idea of any kind of afterlife, much less a hellish one. When he did, though, he conceived of it this way, that when he died, he might, for instance, be forced to relive everything that he'd ever done, even, or especially, the rotten stuff, only this time having insight enough for regret. Sort of like Marley's ghost, or even like Scrooge himself, in the Dickens classic, A Christmas Carol, probably the earliest fictional use of a John Barr Hinge, the three Xmas ghosts, to change the future. But unless hell was just another malicious atrocity to be perpetrated upon helpless victims, goblinhood reasoned, then damnation had to be implemented fairly and justly. That meant being objective, sure, but it's really easy to say. For instance, this is what everybody thinks goblinhood. How the world had been saying that to him and his creator throughout their whole fucking lives. But goblinhood's actions, however rotten, meant nothing without his motives, which had always been based on his subjective point of view. He'd never done anything, for instance, just to be evil, whenever that is, that he'd been sane enough to understand the concept. Given subjectivity as well as objectivity, along with enough insight, for instance, to recognize how warped and twisted his own subjective viewpoints had always been, and why, goblinhood was as likely to feel sorry for himself as he was to feel sorry for anyone else involved, if only at the great and cruel pity of having to run through the events of a ruined life more than once. And surely hell would have to be a place where the comfort of enlightened, informed, and above all, sincere self-pity would sort of have to be impossible, wouldn't it? Meanwhile, he kept all this to himself in the hope that Mandragora wasn't reading his mind at this moment. Fortunately enough, she wasn't, of course. Goblinhood felt that if the Black Widow had never suffered a belief in hell herself, then he would rather die than to risk the chance of corrupting her miraculous innocence. Instead, Goblinhood changed the subject by telling her an amusing anecdote about his presidential campaign, a story called The Transmogrification of Goblinhood. This involved the public access TV broadcast of his rabbit tobacco, Satanic Ameriflora performance, a broadcast which had followed an evening of other Goblinhood tapes, even including something from Citizen Payne, amounting to a sort of a Goblinhood festival on cable TV. Rabbit Tobacco was broadcast on a Sunday, April 5th of 1992. Goblinhood, scheduled to speak to high school students the next day, was highly excited, hoping that a few of the students would be watching so that they could discuss the tape in the context of his topic, freedom of expression. Goblinhood regarded his performance as adult material, it's true, but he also regarded his student associates as young adults. Due to its contents, the 2-hour tape had to start at 10 p.m. on that Sunday night. Goblin Hood's creator and a friend watched the first hour, which included the Gob's notorious safe sex demonstration. "Have I got a candidate or what?" chortled the Gob's creator and campaign manager in regards to this scandal. Then about 10 minutes into the second hour, smack in the middle of a poem, G.H. was abruptly transmogrified into the Metro Guide over on Government Channel 3. It was like watching Kennedy's head blow up on the famous Zapruder film, enthused the excited candidate the next day to his enthralled listeners, few of whom had been watching this, except that the Goblin Hood on television simply disappeared in a massive glitch, and suddenly there the Metro Guide was, smirking blandly at us from the screen as Government Channel 3 seized control of the airwaves. The Metro Guide, by the way, was simply a red, white, and blue listing of all the various crap that was on cable TV at that particular time. Here's what had really happened, according to the friend of the Gobs, to a friend of the Gobs who worked for Public Access TV. The broadcasts all originated mechanically at City Hall. If a tape was flawed in any way, the machine would eject the tape, and some human technician would have to pop the tape back in. Unfortunately, though, all the technicians had gone home at 11 p.m. on Sunday night, leaving the machine to transmit according to its own whims. As soon as they were all safely gone for the night, Goblin Hood conjectured, the machine had promptly detected a flaw in the rabbit tobacco tape, probably the inflammatory line of poetry toward the end about how the machines are taking over. "Our master's machinery, the master race." And had then triumphantly ejected the Gob's tape. There being nobody human to pop it back in, the machine's confederate, the Metro Guide, had smugly held sway for the rest of the hour, until the next tape automatically got its chance. Goblin Hood, of course, had made much of this incident throughout his tawdry political campaign, pretending that he'd undergone an intense religious epiphany of some kind when he'd become one with the Metro Guide, and running around yapping about my personal friend, the Metro Guide, and even claiming that the Metro Guide had endorsed his candidacy, since it was his understanding that microwaves were somehow involved in the TV transmission. He'd often talked of having been microwaved. Sometimes, too, he'd alluded to the scary adventure of being lost in the Metro Guide, as if it were some kind of epic quest. "What was it like in there?" inquired Mandragora now with some animation. "Was it anything like virtual reality?" Goblin Hood gave her an odd look, an almost pitying look. Yeah, he said kind of lamely. "It was just like VR." Actually, G.H. had had an ulterior motive for bringing this up. He started describing the big scene that had remained unseen, the one in which he and the suitcase and cosmic weevil dolls had all tried and convicted Christopher Columbus for war crimes against humanity. Goblin Hood carefully watched Mandragora's face as he described the science experiment in which he'd slowly hanged Columbus, portrayed by Maya in a Columbus mask, and had then attempted to fertilize some dirt with the victim's plastic ejaculate. But Mandra remained impassive at this information, and so Goblin Hood's probing here also remained, like the experiment itself, inconclusive. It had been Goblin Hood's pet theory for a while now that the Black Widows were somehow connected to this bizarre little quasi-magic demonstration, like a weird Alron effect come back, all grown up now, to haunt him. It was probably Mandragora's name which had put this idea in his mind. He reasoned that if real hanged man's semen could grow a real mandrake plant, then maybe imaginary plastic semen from a fake hanging could somehow grow, by some weird stretch of the imagination, a bunch of unreal women or something who could then maybe clone each other. And, well, he had to admit that the Black Widows were pretty unreal, all right. Still, his theory was almost as ridiculous as the idea that being lost in the Metro Guide was just like virtual reality, if not more so. Though both ideas, admittedly, kind of sounded right upon very casual examination. Instead of visibly reacting to the gob's little verbal fishing expedition, Mandragora merely commented blandly that an alternate universe probably existed where the second half of the gob's show had been allowed to run its course on TV, for whatever difference that made. And on that subject, perhaps this is as good a time as any to mention yet another front runner in the sweepstakes to determine who had created the earliest version of fictional multiple universes, for whatever difference that makes. Early in his book, Job, A Comedy of Justice, Robert Heinlein had claimed that credit for the ubiquitous H.G. Wells and his novel, Men Like Gods, if it was a novel, a book which Goblin Hood had never read. While Wells was, almost undisputedly, the progenitor of practically everything in science fiction, however, it's clear that the 1898 Hale story, Hands Off, had predated the 1923 Men Like Gods, though from what G.H. knew of the Wells story, the two yarns weren't even about the same kind of thing. The extremely and sometimes unpleasantly erudite Robert Heinlein was most likely aware of the Hale tale, but perhaps didn't consider it to be true alternate universe material due to the imaginary nature of the alternate world in question. It must be noted, too, that the comment was actually made by Heinlein's protagonist, Alex or Alec, a former fundamentalist Christian in whose home con the works of H.G. Wells had been banned, who thus could be presumed to know very little about imaginative fiction. Some of the most thoughtful what-if stories, interestingly, have been written by historians as a sort of intellectual parlor game. But these writers seem to have little interest in the fantasy genre and take the alternative history motif with the seriousness that probably comes off as a bit stuffy. An example is If It Had Happened Otherwise, a 1931 collection of essays edited by Sir John Collings Squire. In an introduction to the new edition in 1972, Sir John Wheeler Bennett doesn't even mention the myriad science fiction contributions to this field. Then, too, the Wells story, which, as described by Heinlein's character, seemed to have more to do with parallel dimensions than with alternate history, was preceded by at least two genuine alternate history novels, It May Happen Yet by Edmund Lawrence in 1899 about Napoleon invading Britain, and Hubert's Arthur, which also rewrites British history and which was written in 1911, though unpublished until 1935, by Baron Corvo, Frederick W. Rolfe. Most of the information in the preceding two paragraphs was derived from the Visual Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, edited by Brian Ash, Harmony Books, 1977, which can also be consulted regarding the term John Barr Hinge. Goblinhood, only semi-literate in many ways, spent very little time during ruminations of this sort, reflecting upon the concepts of physics and mathematics which related to either parallel worlds and or alternate histories or anything scientific pertaining to other dimensions, all of which he tended to confuse. Since he couldn't figure out ways to pretend to understand such concepts. On the other hand, G.H. was very much interested in words and their sources and in what they signified. Ghosting St. Cloud's book had sharpened this interest in him. One of the aspects of Job, a comedy of justice, which he found interesting, was that Heinlein, in passing, had undertaken to define the word warlock, describing it as a pejorative term whose original meaning was oathbreaker. This agreed with Webster's dictionary, which traced it back to an old English word meaning a breaker of faith. It amused the gob to speculate on how this term had come to signify a practitioner of magic, though many people, pejoratively enough, stipulated that black magic was involved. Others treated the word more simplistically, believing that a warlock was merely the male equivalent of a witch. Perhaps in Old English times, anyone caught practicing magic was regarded as having broken faith with Christianity. Not noted for religious tolerance, those Old English times. Hence the word. Gob couldn't help thinking of the Warlock of Mars, his own sobriquet, whose fictional job in Citizen Kane had been to prevent nuclear war, which almost by definition, given humanity's addiction to warlike behavior, meant to lock the phenomenon of conventional war into place, preventing things from escalating beyond that point of aggression. A popular topic within Nagab's work, this dichotomy between the two types of war. His rationale here in preferring one to the other was that conventional war at least left open the possibility for survival of the species, whereas the other, which could be expanded in his mind to include chemical and bacteriological total war, pretty much didn't. A fine point, perhaps, and one of interest, possibly, only to a student of relative harmlessness, though not, for instance, to someone hopelessly dying in the conventional enemy's torture chamber. In any case, the Warlock of Mars, in the play at least, had originally failed in his warlocking mission, whether as a matter of broken faith or not. Along the same kind of lines, though, the first part of the Shogun Squirrel's pompous little title was an interesting word. As Goblinhood understood it, the word meant supreme warlord in feudal Japan, the strongest samurai war leader who seized power and ruled by strength of arms, no matter who the Japanese emperor was. But if one uses the word gun in the sense of hired gun or gunslinger, the shogun was the equivalent of the fastest gun in the West. And if one equates the sound sho to the word sho, as in prize-winning show cat at a cat show, if there even are cat shows, then the shogun, the top gun, was sort of on show as the greatest military symbol in hyper-military feudal Japan, the show gun, as it were. In gangster lingo, this might translate into Mr. Big, which would fit in perfectly here because Mr. Big was exactly who the Shogun Squirrel thought it was pretending to be during the lamentable and ill-conceived Squirrel Cage episode. And for that matter, the same goes for all the rest of the squirrel's various hijinks and lowjinks in general. Meanwhile, whilst wool gathering on the subject of warlords, Goblinhood found himself reminded of Joshua, who had also, in passing, figured in the book Job, a Comedy of Justice, and whose antics were too unlike the prevention of nuclear war. Goblinhood remembered a dream he'd recently had about Joshua, a dream which the Gob might have written down and had not other events intervened, particularly at the Shogun Squirrel's instigation. But the Gob had, during a free moment, troubled to look up Joshua's story, recognizing that his dream had confused Joshua with an earlier figure named Joseph. Interestingly, he'd found during this research that the dream had even confused the role of Joshua, who had indeed defeated Jericho, but by knocking down its walls. It wasn't until four chapters later in the biblical book of Joshua that the warrior had commanded both the sun and the moon to stand still for a whole day, mostly just to impress the other Israelites with what a big shot Joshua was. Joshua, who liked to hang people when he wasn't having them stoned, was certainly the shogun or supreme warlord on those occasions, at least as far as humans were concerned. But the Mr. Big of the situation was plainly the god Yahweh, from whom Joshua derived his absurd powers. But all this led the gob's drug-rattled mind into a really off-the-wall digression concerning the late St. Cloud. St. Cloud was certainly acting like Mr. Big when he took out his entire solar system, but that wasn't what interested Goblinhood now. Instead, the gob's fancy was snared by the memory of a strange story which St. Cloud had once told him long ago. Somewhere in the gob's book, it had been asserted that St. Cloud's mind played tricks on him, occluding actual events and covering them up with ridiculously transparent screen memories. The occasional accidental discovery of this process was, in fact, supposed to have strongly motivated St. Cloud in his search for truth, in his efforts to rip away the veil of illusion and find out what was really going on. But to Goblinhood, the mental problem in question seemed to sum up the St. Cloud situation, and somehow a lot of other things besides. St. Cloud had once narrated to Goblinhood an example of what's being talked about here in the form of a story which went as follows. Once upon a time, like Goblinhood's creator, with whom he had a lot in common, Raymond St. Cloud had worked in a basement art studio. In a corner of the studio were some old love letters that he prized highly in a paper bag. The basement was supposed to be dry, but one day he discovered that it wasn't. It never had been, but a thick old rug had disguised this fact. He discovered it by accident when the rug, which was covered with books and magazines and a paper bag full of love letters, started wetly squishing and soaking his knees while he knelt there one day looking for a particular book. St. Cloud was, naturally, devastated by the extensive water damage to his property. Frantically, he completely cleaned and rearranged his basement room, this time keeping everything off of the floor. Then, depressed as hell, he got completely wasted, totally binged out, apparently hoping to forget, like a foreign legionnaire of his own basement studio. Months passed, and an unforeseen time came when St. Cloud was packing up his stuff to move. He decided to start packing up the basement by going over to the corner to get the bag of love letters off of the floor. But the letters were gone. So was the corner. It had all been changed after the deluge, of course. The problem was this. St. Cloud had been staring right into that corner for months now, because his chair directly faced it. For months, he'd been nonchalantly assuming that the precious letters were right where they'd always been, even though he could plainly see that they weren't. But he hadn't seen it. He passed the spot every day for several months, both entering and leaving the basement, and he'd never seen it. He'd never even noticed that the corner was different. This was, in fact, the first time he'd even remembered why he'd cleaned and changed the basement. An outside chance exists that the letters had been removed by their writer, the only other person who ever came into the basement. But she seemed genuinely upset when he told her about it, nor had she any reason for deception. Besides, that still wouldn't explain the screen memory, or non-stop hallucination, or whatever it was, that all was well with the letters, until by chance he went to get them and discovered that they hadn't been there for months. There was no memory whatsoever of anything having ever happened to the letters. So what had happened to them? And what in hell had happened to his mind? Naturally, he tore up his apartment, looking for the letters and packing. The poor bastard reasoned that even if he couldn't see the letters, as long as there was nothing left after his packing chores, then the letters would have to have been packed too, which was important because they weren't the kind of things that either he or his now furious correspondent wanted to leave lying around for strangers to see. And even when the apartment was totally bare, he was still searching empty corners for the phantom bag. He never found it. So what had happened to the letters? Unlike Poe's famous purloined letter, they weren't hiding in plain sight, and St. Cloud doubted whether even the famous Chevalier C. Auguste Dupin could have solved the mystery of St. Cloud's defective perceptions and broken mind. How could even drugs keep such a specialized hallucination going for that long? It gave force to the old adage that we see only what we wish to see. Eventually, during his mind-racking and laborious search, St. Cloud developed, out of necessity, a tentative hypothesis. The letters must have been so badly damaged that he'd thrown them away. That must have been what he'd gotten so depressed about, though he'd been using other water-damaged stuff, reference materials, for example, for months without giving the letters a single thought. The event had so badly depressed him that, vowing never to think of it again, he'd built up the cheering illusion, or screen memory, or whatever, that nothing had ever happened, nothing bad had ever happened to the letters. Of course, he wasn't supposed to find out the truth, ever. Clearly, this mental process hadn't taken into account the possibility of his ever moving from this particular house. But for this unexpected variable, he'd probably have gone on deluding himself that the letters were still intact in that same spot, even after the eventual entropic heat death of the universe. Still, this sounded plausible. The more he considered it, the more he could almost remember seeing the ruined letters, totally waterlogged and all stuck together. He could almost remember seeing the blurry script swim further through a mist of his own tears as he threw away this evidence that someone had once loved him, so depressing himself that he promptly forgot about the whole thing. Almost. But this itself seemed and felt like a screen memory in the making, a way of persuading himself that the disappearance and his bizarre non-reaction to it made some kind of logical sense. Given the alternatives, it was easy to see why his mind might just offer up any kind of half-assed story that might convince St. Cloud that, of course, he knew all about what had happened to the letters. No problem. Case closed. Class dismissed. St. Cloud had never discovered the actual truth about the missing letters. He'd had to settle amid dim and basically groundless suspicions of the letter writer. Suspicions that he couldn't truly believe in except out of desperation. He'd finally had to settle for that blotched and illegible half-memory of ruined letters in his head. And whatever the real memory was, he could only be sure that it looked just like those terminally damaged love letters by now. Wherever his mind had stashed it, he was sure, too, that he'd never really wanted things to go this way, no matter how badly he'd felt at the time. Speaking off the cuff, this wasn't like the cognitive dissonance, if that's the right term,